We're back. It's the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm your co-host, Jason Snell. Across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Jason.
We are once again back. We are once again proving what dependable professionals we are.
Tireless. Tireless professionals seeking oral justice.
Is tireless a synonym of tired?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good.
I think it qualifies.
All right, because I am that. I'm tireless then. I'm really feeling tireless this
You're
week.
You're really feeling tireless. Yeah. It can happen.
It does. It happens. We do have some TV things to talk about and some letters.
A few.
It's good. So a big piece by you this week that we should talk about, which is let's have an emotional gut punch or two as a couple of series wrap up their seasons or entire bag in the case of The Leftovers. Leftovers, series finale, Americans season finale. And you rolled those two things together and drew some parallels and talked about it's like the power of endings almost.
Yeah, you know, it really came about because of being tireless, basically, being tired and behind. And when I was in New York for so long, I fell even further behind. And so, I wasn't able to get them done in time. And so I was like, dang, I gotta somehow I want to write about both of these shows, but now I don't have the time for it. And it was just like binging and playing catch up. And I had some bigger ideas about maybe blander probably, but just talking about, how both of them wrapped up. Did they stick the landing? How did they do? But the bigger picture was pretty clear as I raced through to catch up on these shows, and just so devastating. And I really love both of these shows so much, and they're so different. But yeah, it's I wouldn't recommend binging both of them at the same time. I started to see some real parallels about they're great shows. They don't have a very big audience, but they have a huge impact as far as like creatively and critically. They're super acclaimed, but they have a huge impact when they tell emotional stories. And boy, you know, the Americans had to earn it because they had to build it up so that you cared about all these characters. And The Leftovers is kind of the same thing, but you got into this crazy world of theirs that immediately starts with like grief and loss, because 2% of the world's population vanishes from the planet. And what does that look like? And if you watch the first season of Leftovers, it looks really bleak to everybody who stayed. They're just unbelievable babies, like taken out of their arms, out of their stomachs sometimes. It's just so much stuff, like brothers and sisters and moms and dads and all, just unbelievably bleak stuff. And you're immediately into that feeling because it's a story about loss. Whereas the Americans, you earned it over a certain number of years, and the tension just kept ratcheting up. You know, in the early days, it was spy, spy, spy. But it was really about also like, what the hell are they going to do, these Russian spies, with these American kids? And then when they moved, the story of Paige wanting to find out and then being told and then meant possibly being recruited in and all that stuff that does to you as a parent. I just thought, well, look, if you watched both of these shows, which ended within 5 days of each other, good luck for your psyche.
So let's, now that The Leftovers is over, it can be kind of evaluated as a unit. What is your thought about it as a completed series? How does it rate?
I will say this, the ending and the cumulatively, it was pretty amazing. The ending season, the final season, 7 episodes, I thought was so great that it was, I think it's going to be the show that makes me move the line a little bit. And I've always sort of like been not willing to budge on my concept that to be a great series, you have to be considered, you know, a Hall of Fame top 5, right? I mean, top 10, I could loosen the things a little bit, but like, if you're going to get into the top 5 discussion, and who knows if they will, but I always said, You cannot be in the top five discussion unless you've gone five seasons or more. Because so that ruled out, and I've had this argument on Twitter before, you know, that ruled out Deadwood because it only did three seasons. Hmm. And Alan Sepinwall and I have, you know, talked about this, and he obviously doesn't believe in it because he loves Deadwood. And I loved Deadwood too, but I didn't think it was a very great ending to that season. I felt like it kind of got just ended mid story, and it only went three episodes, or I'm sorry, seasons. And so I was like, because also, and I think the greater series go longer if they can maintain their greatness. That's why I have Mad Men at number one, because it risks more by showing more, you know, because this is a continuing storyline on all these shows. And if you could be the greatest show in the world, and then you go completely off the rails in one season, and you are now completely out of the discussion for, you know, it's like the greatest gymnast of all time, and he or she does a flip on the bar and misses it and tumbles into the crowd. It's over. There's no gold.
Right.
So like that, it's all there. You know, if you could be the 100-meter champion and never beat Usain Bolt, if he trips, all 4 years of the work is wasted. So that's what it is with these shows. The more they keep trying to perform and stay on the track. So that was always my thing. I think The Leftovers this season was so great, I'm going to rethink that possibility, because I think this is one of the great, it's going to go down as one of the greatest, I think, episodes and season finale seasons of all time. But as I wrote in my piece, that only works if you already buy into what admittedly is a very weird concept for the show, where they're not interested in telling you what is happening logically. You have to sort of figure things out, and it's very, very, it's very vague, and it leaves a lot to the imagination, and Americans don't like that. American TV viewers do not like that. They want something concrete. They don't want it to be, oh, it could be whatever you would like it to be. They don't like that, as obviously the finale of the Sopranos proved, among other things. But I just think it was that great, Jason.
It's got to be gratifying for Damon Lindelof to have people say nice things about a final season and a final episode of something he worked on, right?
Right, and yeah, I mean, totally agree. And I can't remember. Are you a Leftovers person?
I have only seen the first. I haven't even seen the whole first season. I have seen most of the first season of it. I'm gradually, every time I have a moment where I'm like feeling like I'm ready for a bring down.
It's a bring down. There's no way around it. It's a bring down. And that first season especially is a bring down.
See, I thought you were going to ask if I was a lost last season apologist, and I kind of am. I think I like the last season of Lost more than most people, and I like the Lost finale more than most people. But you know, whatever. It's people now that listeners are yelling at me. But I will. My argument with the Lost finale is that I think emotionally, and this I think has a lot to do with how different people watch TV, and it goes back to what you're saying about what most people want from a television show. Like the Lost finale to me, I thought was entirely fulfilling on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are like, that's not what they were looking for. They were looking for, maybe they were looking for that too, but they were looking for storytelling and plot resolution and answers to questions and things like that. And it's like, I feel like that was a great finale on the level of emotional resolution with the characters you spent many years with. But it turns out most people totally don't buy that, don't subscribe to that point of view. Fair enough.
Well, as somebody who watched both, I do agree with you. I didn't think it was as bad an ending as and especially if you can get a chance to go back and rewatch certain things about shows like that. But there are amazing parallels between Lost and The Leftovers in what Damon Lindelof is trying to do. It's weirdly, I think he was trying to move so far away from Lost with this project. You know, he waited a long time to actually do something like this. But he loved this story. And he, you know, basically, I think what attracted him at the beginning was when him and Tom Parada basically said, we never explain. We'll never explain what happened. And it freed him of having to have that burden. And it allowed him to tell the press, day one before any, you know, we had seen it before anybody had seen it, but we had seen it. We come back and at press tour, and he basically said, "You will never ever know. We will never explain it. We will not tell you how this happened and what the answer was. It's not a mystery story."
The and, point is how people deal with the unknowable, right?
Yes, exactly. It is and it's really interesting how that freed him up to tell a story. But what it did was, instead of distancing Damon Lindelof from Lost, it actually brought him closer to, I think, kind of a purer version of what he might have wanted to do with Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can tell, and first of all, there's all kinds of Lost allusions in Leftovers. If you see it, there's so many parallels to it. And I think some of it is him being cheeky, and some of it is him just saying that people are crazy and they're reading too much into it. but as far as, like, I think he learned a lesson from Lost, and it was like a practice run. And then when he got to this one, which was a much smaller run, and then completely being free from having to solve anything, it allowed him to tell a kind of story that was so creatively fun, but it didn't actually always have to, like, link itself back up to logic.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know if he would agree. I actually have not read much stuff from Damon. I know everybody, he did an exit interview with virtually everyone. So maybe he's addressed it. I have not read it, but I think this was a great, I think we learned something about his storytelling strength. And I think it's because he makes things that are evocative, and he can really move you in a way. That's his strength. He can move you in a way where, like, he can show you this fantastic world, and you're like, "Oh, but did that really happen? Like, oh, what a trip!" And he's like, "I don't know, did it?" You know, that's kind of cool, I think, if you open your mind to go with that. So that's the only reason I'm sort of backtracking and saying, like, for me, this is in the discussion as one of the greatest finale seasons ever, but it won't be for anybody who doesn't buy in to that concept where,
sure,
it doesn't have to make sense. And I will say something really interesting. When he said that he, and this is for people who have seen it, and it's not going to spoil anything for anybody else, but when he said at the beginning, no spoilers, he basically just said, "We're never going to know why this departure happened. Why 2% of the world's population, you know, the mystery is, can it happen again? Will it happen again?" Those are things that are in play, but explaining how it happened and what happened to those people, not a thing. And it's interesting because I think a couple of years later, a couple of seasons later, people kind of forgot that. And I think there were some initial misreadings about things are tied together in the last 7 episodes as much as anything in The Leftovers ties together at all or makes sense. There is a narrative thread that you can find, but there's a really moving final scene. And I think there was, when critics, and that's, thank God I was not writing on deadline, I think when people wrote about it right after it aired or they watched it or whatever, I think a lot of them came to a conclusion that was not what actually happened. And some of them have gone back, and I've read a couple of things from critics I like, and they've said, "I originally thought this was happening, but now I don't believe that's true." And it's not true, because it's just, you have to listen to what Lindelof said. And there's so many things about logic in the show that wouldn't make sense. And then you kind of understand why these people are having this discussion and what that discussion means if you understand from the beginning that Damon Lindelof did not lie. There is no answer here.
Right.
I loved it. But again, people don't like ambiguity, and I don't think people, and I'm not somebody who likes to, like, watch a show where that doesn't have any rules. And you and I have talked about
totally,
this before.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked about that, like, many times. You got to have a Bible and you got to stick to it. And I think
your rules can be kind of whatever, but you got to have them and stick to them. You got to be consistent.
Exactly. And I think that he was consistent and he stuck with them. And even though some people were like, "I still don't get it." And that was true of Sense8 as well. But I think Lindelof is a little more structured, and I think he's a little more true to the narrative. Like, I have rules, whereas Sensei, I think those kind of blurred a little bit at the end. But yeah, I just loved it. I thought this was emotional storytelling, and that's essentially the gist of the piece that I wrote, because there was so much emotion in both shows, and it's just they ended it within 5 days of each other, and neither it's not a surprise that both were emotional, but that both are so great and they ended so close to each other, and they were so particularly Leftovers, so exhaustingly emotional. I felt like that was necessary to write about that.
So now The Americans has one more season to run.
Mm-hmm.
What expectations, if any, do you have about that? Because it's going to be going, speaking of going into a final season, it's going into its final season. So do you have expectations, story expectations, emotional expectations? What thinking about that last season?
Yeah, no, I do. And I think, weirdly, I have been critical of them back in like the third season or whatever, about how they left things and talked to the guys about it after they did it and heard what they did. I didn't mind this season at all. I almost never read anybody else, but I have read them post piece, and there's a lot of people who didn't like the pacing and they thought it was too slow. Seppenwall, I'm sure he was one of them too. I don't know about Poniewozik, if it was him or not, but and I'm sure I always get JP's name wrong, but pronunciation of it wrong. But
you got it, nailed it.
I don't know. I've heard him say it so many times. I'm not sure I get it right, but but he's also used to that. So I think, and then maybe one other person that I read who I really like. There were references to it being slow. Now, a lot of the fans thought it was super slow and too slow for them. They thought it was like spinning wheels and things. And I think it was a little slower than most. And I, as I said in my piece, a bridge season, which is what this is, it's a bridge to the final season. And if you look back at Mad Men, season 6 was a bridge to 7. And so a lot of bad things can happen in bridge seasons because you are kind of plate spinning a little bit. But for me, the excuse for The Americans was, and I do say, yeah, sure, parts of it could have been tighter. No debate from me on that one. But as far as how did it lose, was it less great? No, because to get the emotional impact that I wrote about, you have to watch these two parents, these two spies and these parents and this married couple struggle with like them. They have to be overwhelmed at work, which means you have to have them out on a number of assignments. They have to start losing faith in some of those assignments, which means that some of those assignments, they're not super exciting when they go awry. They just kind of peter out. You're like, eh, it's, and is that super dramatic? No. But if your goal is to say, okay, these two people who are thinking they might want to get out of the spy game, and what do they do? And do they continue to bring their daughter into the spy game? Do they want her to do that? Because now they're really falling out of it. And they're like, Jesus, we're kind of burnt. Do we want to get her into this? And then there's this thing like, do we pick them up and run back to Russia? And does this, you know, what's going to happen to our family if we do that? And who do we tell? So there was all, there's the season, this season of theirs, of The Americans, it was really they had to earn the weight that the characters were feeling. And unfortunately, that means they have to be, you have to tell things where it's not things blowing up and spies chases and things. It's just much, and not that the show's ever been fast anyway, but
sure.
I was not worried at all about the pacing of The Americans. I thought it was, what they did was necessary to sort of say, okay, the Jennings are now really tired and they have a lot of doubts and their kids are at an age now and have made changes where what the stakes of the decisions that the Jennings are about to make are so much greater. So I thought they earned all that.
All right, one more season.
And I think, and now again, just to finish that thought off that you asked, I think next season, yeah, now it's going to go faster. It's going to be more pulse pounding. It can still be utterly heartbreaking.
Well, and you don't know what ride they'll take you on because you know now that they can't reset. They don't need to reset at all. They can just barrel toward a resolution. There's no sort of like, well, we need to, you know what I mean? Like there are rules about a show that is coming back for another season that it's probably not going to throw away its premise or kill off its characters because it has to come back next year. But in that last year, They could literally do anything, take the story anywhere, play with time, play with characters coming and going, because this is it. There's no more.
There is no more. Absolutely. I think you're totally right. And I think that's, and then they will do that. And I think it will be surprising. But I also wouldn't be surprised if an ending that fans have already imagined could happen, because, you know, somebody was saying, like, well, they can't just, like, stay here and, like, retire, quote unquote. I'm like, well, except the entire concept for this idea came to Joe Weisberg because of a story of that nature. Russian spies who had been here since the Cold War were in New Jersey.
Yeah, exactly.
And they were elderly. And so he's like, hey, that's kind of awesome. What if we took it and moved it back into the 80s? But so it could end like that. And I would be totally fine seeing them in their old age. But I don't think that's how it's going to end. But
there's also a story about, I think it's that they based it on, that it's the kid. Again, it's kids who didn't realize their parents were spies. And they end up in this situation where the kids are treated as are have to go back to Russia, and they don't speak Russian and they don't understand it, and they can't get back to America. And there's all sorts of possibilities there. That they can mine.
Yeah. I just think there's just so much. And the way that they ended the season, I think that there's a lot of, without giving anything away, it's just, they're both exhausted, but Philip, who's always been a little bit less, you know, into the spy game, is the most exhausted. And I think he's a wild card. I don't think you can say what he's going to do. But yeah, it's two great seasons, and it was way to wrap them up.
So now, having talked for a while about The Leftovers and The Americans, let's mention your TV review that posted this week, because it's another one of TV's great series premiering in a couple of nights. TNT's Claws. How's that for a transition?
Well, now you make it sound like a shark movie.
No, it's not. It's about manicurists. It's about nails. And I want to tell you my story. Can I tell you my story?
Yes, you tell me your story.
So working on the West Coast on a magazine for many years, one of the things we would often do is go to the Maggie Awards, which is the Western Publications Association. I have no idea if it still exists. At LAX, it was like at the Westin LAX every year. Fly down, and there was a banquet. And so it's people from magazines from all over the West going to this banquet for the best in categories and art direction and overall magazine. And, you know, we would be up for like some art direction and feature articles and in the tech category and all that. And I would often sit near, just because it wasn't that big a venue, sit near people from one of the two, because it was mostly trade, right? Trade magazines. So there was a nails or there was a health category, but two of the publications in that category every year that were nominated were Nails Magazine and Nail Pro Magazine.
Oh, the bitter enemies, probably.
And they did not like each other, let me tell you. There was some bad blood between the two nail care magazines, like to the point where one of them would win and there'd be huge whooping and then there'd be like coming from the other table.
Just bitterness in the nail world.
What I'm saying is the nail care industry, it's serious business. This is what I'm saying.
It's a hotbed of
drama. Of drama, which is what TNT's Claws, I assume, is all about.
The thing that flipped me out a little bit about the Claws, it's not my kind of show. I don't know what kind of show it thinks it wants to be right now. It's funny. I have a little bit of annoyance that my actual lead and stuff was toned down for the online, which should probably not happen. But beyond that, I was just basically saying, like, what struck me about Claws when I watched it, it was like, wait a minute, this is supposed to be a show about women, crazy eclectic women working in a nail salon in South Florida or mid Florida. But it's kind of really more about like spring breakers and with Dixie Mafia and like white guys who think they're hip hop thugs and like just like drug running and money laundering and like woo, crazy over the top Florida Gator type show. and like guns and yeah, like Spring Breakers. And I was like, what? The more I watched, yeah, I couldn't get through too many, by the way. But it was very clear to me that the writer and the director and everybody, they were so much more interested in the Dixie Mafia type of stuff. Cause, you know, Dean Norris, who was in Breaking Bad, and he was so great as Hank, the DEA agent, he's the Dixie Mafia boss. And Niecy Nash runs the nail salon. And so Niecy Nash is the star. And just for the record, and I wrote this in my review, Niecy Nash believes that she's in a straight up drama, which I think would be great. I also think if you took the show and remodeled it as a comedy about women working in a nail salon, it would be totally great. That could be its own show. But when you move them together and have a nail salon and the Dixie Mafia running money, and it's clear that Dean Norris he's playing in a different kind of drama than Niecy Nash is. Like, I like the fact that Niecy Nash didn't play the nail salon part for like laughs. It's not a sitcom-y part. She's serious, but she's playing it like she's on an HBO series. And Dean Norris is playing it like the director said, okay, we want you to be white trash, Dixie Mafia, crazy, insanely crazy. Just get that, ratchet that accent up, and we're going to surround you with like the funniest looking, like gangbanger, like, I don't know, meth head, white trash people they could possibly be, and you play that up. And you put them together, and I don't know. As I said in my review, the show exists because Pineapple Pizza exists.
Okay.
Somebody's going to like it.
But I love pineapple pizza.
Well, well, you know,
it's
got to
have pepperoni. It has to have pepperoni on it too. It's okay. All part of the, you know, part of the same deal.
Doesn't work for me, but so that maybe you could actually like Claws and it'd be awesome.
I'm not going to bet on it, but it's possible. It's not impossible that would be the case. All right, anyway, it's there. It's available. Claws is available for people who would like it.
It's there, yeah.
Should we do some letters?
Let's do that. Sure.
One follow-up about our conversation about shows that somebody out there was looking for that are kind of pleasant and have pleasant people in them and are not too jarring.
Yeah, because I think that was the Detectorists was the
jump-off
point. Yeah, they
liked Detectorists. Mm-hmm. Art from the 425 suggests Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah, sure. And funny too, and sweet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. I think that's a good one. Thanks, Art. David from the +61 wrote in to say, "I'm upset with Netflix for two things. First, for canceling Sense8. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience to watch. And secondly, delaying season 2 of The Expanse here in the +61. Has it been over a month since it finished in the U.S.? Are they waiting, or it has been, are they waiting till after the DVD release in the U.S. to maximize disc and iTunes sales?" I think this is a misunderstanding of what's going on here. The studio that makes the show sold it to Sci-Fi Channel in America, and in most of the rest of the world, it sold it to Netflix. And I believe Sci-Fi Channel, because they were one of the co-producers on it, has an exclusive window where they get to air it, and it doesn't air anywhere else in the world. And then it follows in the rest of the world when that window closes. So it's one of those things where it's actually two different organizations. I'm sure Netflix would like to run it immediately, actually, is what I've heard, is that they don't like running things weekly, but that this delay after the whole season is over is because of something involving Sci-Fi Channel in the U.S. kind of having a window where they have it and other countries don't. That's my understanding. So it's not, I think, it's not a uniform thing where it's like, why is Netflix holding on to this? Because it's actually not even a show owned by Netflix. So that's my story there. Although who can tell, because they aren't very communicative, but it sounds like that's what's going on, is that there's a, for these shows that are kind of retrofit into Netflix, there are some existing contracts that limit the distribution. So I agree, it's dumb. They should put that up like as soon as it's over here in the U.S. But,
and that's a show you do like.
I do like The Expanse. Mm-hmm. I do very much. Anyway, so there you go, David. That's there. There's the reason. Here's one from Jason, not me, in area code unknown. He's written before, but
really?
But he didn't leave the area code this time. Yeah, I know.
Oh, boy. It's a fumble.
But it's some more Netflix questions. Okay. It's okay. Is it safe to assume that existing seasons of canceled Netflix series will remain on the service indefinitely? And what metrics does Netflix use to judge the performance of its shows? Ratings in the traditional sense wouldn't be appropriate. Netflix has trained us to watch anytime we want, and we take advantage of that. And then what is the likelihood that a canceled Netflix show could be picked up by another service? What do you think?
Well, the second question indicates he didn't read my column about that, because then he would have had that answer, because the cancellations of the Get Down and Sense8 showed that there probably are metrics that are in play.
We don't really know exactly what that metric is, but there must be one, surely.
Yeah, one or more. But the ones that we now know are ratings matter to them. That's a big deal. Because everybody just said, well, ratings don't matter to them. And they don't really have to, because it's a subscription service. But I think the greater point is that they're not going to... So money matters too. And that was my whole column was about this. And again, everybody, including me, is like, oh, money doesn't matter to these guys. They have tons of it. They're drowning in it. And they can just make more of it when they find another country or another part of the country to roll out their service. So basically my column was, money does matter to them in the sense, and ratings, in the sense that they're not going to throw a ton of money. And those, both the Get Down and Sense8, were super expensive. They were not going to throw bad money at shows that don't do well in ratings. So we now know that those two metrics are in play, but to what extent, we don't know, or any other metrics. And the third question is, no, I don't think anyone is going to pick up any Netflix cast-offs. Yeah, I just don't think that's going to happen.
And my understanding is that that this Sense8 in particular, I read a post from the show's co-creator, Joe Straczynski, saying Netflix owns the show. They own the show. So that's it. If they don't want it, it's gone. It's very simple.
Yeah.
They own it. They choose its life or death. This is not a case where it's some other studio and they're shopping it around, like Netflix basically can say no and that's the end. And then as for number one, I think it's safe to assume that existing seasons of canceled Netflix shows will stay on Netflix forever.
Yes, indefinitely. It's spent money, and there's no reason for them to pull it off, because part of what they want is they want a library. They want a back catalog, and that little deep bench philosophy has always been their goal. So, like, lots of people in the whole world have not seen Sense8, and when they discover it, they're going to love it, I think, like I did, and there's going to be two seasons for them to binge through, and then someone somewhere else in the world will find it. So to have that content on the service, it'd be foolish to take it off.
And if one of those canceled shows ends up showing some amazing metrics, then maybe they go, all right, maybe we do a revival now.
Yeah, or a spinoff or some weird thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sense9.
Yeah, we find a different cluster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Will from the 404 has a good hypothetical that he wants to run by you.
404, that's Atlanta. Right.
All right.
I believe that's Hotlanta.
Have shows become disposable commodities like music did in the age of streaming? The catalogs are rich and large. Consumption is on your schedule. Sample an episode or two before you're hooked, or bail without hesitation. Watch lists are like libraries. Podcasts like TVTM and outlets like THR provide curated playlists to consume. Networks are losing relevance in the eyes of viewers, similar to how no one thinks about what a record label is churning out. Do you think TV will go the way of streaming music and offer a single monthly subscription service with nearly identical libraries available, with a few exclusive sprinkled in, so we only need one service? So in other words, more like Spotify and Apple Music rather than what we currently think of as like Netflix and Amazon Prime Video. Does the structure of the TV industry prevent this consolidation, or did the TV industry learn something watching the music industry's collapse and vow to never let that happen? I think this is an interesting idea. The idea that is the logical endpoint of this, things, catalogs that are mostly alike or not.
Well, I don't think this could ever happen, because, you know, I just don't see it. Like, how do you, everybody's still in business. The five networks are not going to like agree that they're all going to go away except for CBS, which gets to run the service. You know, I don't, I definitely think we're at some point we're going to move to a future where streaming it when you want it and whatever, that's going to happen for sure. But you know, like people are, you know, I always tell people who are like, I consider you an early adopter. You're getting to sample iOS before anybody else does. You're getting to touch, put your hands on sure. hardware before anybody else does. You are the ultimate early adopter. I feel like I'm kind of an early adopter because I like technology. I'm not great at it by any means. Like, I think I can do it, but like, I also just text you in the middle of the night. How do I do this? What's this plug for? So I consider myself kind of an early adopter. I always tell people, think about yourself and then add 5 years. And that's the rest of the country that is not, quote unquote, an early adopter or tech interested. And so we're only at the point now where streaming, I think, is going to become a real threat because people who are very, very late adopters are suddenly learning how to stream. And they're like, yeah, I got this. It's not that hard. I can do it. And so, yeah, but like moving into the future where everything is streaming, not going to happen so much. There's still going to be some over the air stuff, but I don't know what that future looks like, but it's not just going to be like, the networks are all still going to be, well, I would say most of them are still going to be around in some form or other. Maybe the CW becomes just a streaming service. Who knows?
I feel like it's just not a great, it's an interesting idea, but I'm not seeing it only because there's so much value in having exclusives. Like the last thing, it's a little bit like how nobody wants to be a dumb pipe. That is the way that we always talk about it in telecommunications. Like the cable company doesn't want to be like literally all cable companies are identical and you can get everything from everyone. And that's the case actually. And wireless services, it's sort of like they get reduced to just being a transferer and they're not the ones creating the content. This is why Verizon is buying lots of websites and things like that. It's because they want to be a part of that. So like if you're Netflix, you never want to just have your catalog be the same things that are available everywhere. And that's why they're spending money creating exclusives. So I think everybody wants to differentiate on content. And the danger is going to be that not everybody is going to be able to pay for all the services. So there's going to be some pressure. If you're a studio, there's a question of like how many, what's the value of selling your show to all services versus only one service exclusively. But it feels like right now that's the way this is working is that all these services want exclusives. Mm-hmm. And that's just how it's going to be. And then the back catalog is where you're going to see some similarities, maybe, but not the premium, the new stuff that everybody wants to see. It just feels like that's going to be different. It's intriguing to think about this, though. I like this letter because it is asking this question, like, how did the music industry get where it is now? But I think I think consuming music is different enough from movies and TV that it feels like this is it's a different conversation. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's interesting. I mean, there's some definitely interesting tech and industry-related questions in that overall question, but I don't think we're there yet where we just see like one, everybody gets a quote-unquote TV from traditional quote-unquote network TV from one place.
Well, I mean, the example would be like your YouTube TV and Sling and DirecTV and all of those. Those are essentially what he's talking about here, which is a commodity cord-cutting thing where you get like the regular TV channels, and those are all the same. And maybe that's the answer here, is that there are really two tiers, which doesn't really exist in music, which is there's the stuff that everybody gets, and then there's the stuff that's the premium tier that you have to pay extra for. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's where we'll end up, is the networks as we think of them will be available everywhere on all services, and then there's going to be the stuff you have to pay extra for, and those differentiate on exclusivity, which is exactly what the case is with going back in time with HBO and Showtime from time immemorial. It's you know, you have to pay extra for them because they've got stuff that's totally locked up that nobody else has. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, CBS can put, you know, I see a future where they're putting more and more of their stuff on their streaming service.
That's true too, right?
They
build that stuff up on All Access, at which point they've put up another barrier to people just sort of like to their content being taken for granted and being
mm-hmm.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. A few more letters here. Let's see. here, let's see, what do I have here? Dean of the 707, currently in the 559, our old traveling buddy.
He's moving. He's on the move.
So he says, I'm posting this on June 6th, so this is just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to be eating a Taco Bell taco next Tuesday if the Warriors steal a game in Cleveland. Well, they already did that.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what happens tonight when the Warriors will be going for the championship,
mm-hmm.
Everybody already gets a taco. He says it's an incredibly dumb tie-in, but I'm buying into it, which made me think, what commercial tie-ins worked on TV shows and which ones didn't? I smile thinking of Carl Weathers teaching acting lessons at Burger King because of the unlimited drinks. I liked on Community when Greendale was going to turn into Subway University, but I hated Subway on Chuck, where people kept talking about those sandwiches as if they were fine cuisine. Mm. I hated the commercials for Cars and Disneyland on Modern Family, and of course they were essential on Mad Men. So as tech tries to free us from ads, they'll probably be embedding ads within shows more and more. When do you find these ads within shows acceptable, and when do you find them annoying? That's a great question, Dean.
That is really good. Well, I mean, yeah, those are really good examples too. Dean's got a good history. I think that ABC Disney tie-ins are obviously pretty much always going to be a little bit heavy-handed. You know, my favorite one was the Arrested Development, because that's when they just said, I mean, they were flailing. They were going out anyway. So they're like, they needed the money and they took it. And then they decided that they would just make fun of taking the money. So it was so meta.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like to the point where the camera closes in and back on the, you know, the Burger King, whatever, logo on the outside. And that, Henry Winkler literally jumps over a shark in that episode. So it's like, I like that. I like how they take themselves. Don't take themselves seriously.
And in the same vein, I'm going to say my favorite product placement in a TV show is the Verizon Wireless 30 Rock placement, where literally Liz Lemon and Jack Donaghy have a whole conversation about Verizon Wireless phones and how they're everywhere because they offer great service. And at the end, Tina Fey literally turns to the camera and says, can we have our money now?
Yeah, that was great.
Amazing. So I think Mad Men is a show about advertising, so that's different. But I think the product placement, my favorite product placement is when it is meta and it's winking, or the brand that's being placed is in on the joke. That they're cool with it being kind of a wacky, fun kind of thing. But the ones that are dead serious, where it's just like, do, I guess all the FBI agents in the X-Files drive this particular brand of car.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? Yeah, go ahead.
That just makes me roll my eyes. It's just because it doesn't. Then it feels fake. It's like, why are all the good guys driving Buicks?
Right.
The one that killed me was I still think of it. In fact, Nissan did the product placement on Heroes. And when I watched it before I gave up on that show, one of the things that made me laugh is the aggressive product placement. Like the cheerleader is given a car for her 16th birthday, and I think the line is actually, "Oh, the new Rogue," like she's a car. She became a car commercial. She's the 16-year-old is well aware of various brands of Nissan car,
right,
and can be impressed by this one. Come on. And then Hiro, the Japanese guy who can stop time. At one point, I remember he needs a car and he's in a parking garage and he shouts, "Oh, Nissan Versa." And to this day, I see Nissan Versas and I go, "Oh, Nissan Versa." So, you know, it can be an unintentional comedy too, to do the product placement.
I think people are getting better at it. Like the one that struck me right when you were telling this story, because, you know, it's so hard to get these questions. And of course, we don't really do any prep work. You do the bulk of the prep work, but even that's...
I copy and paste it, but I don't tell you what the questions are. So there's no preparation. Yeah.
And the way my brain works, which is basically a sieve, is not well. So that's the short story on my brain. But I do remember a distinct example of hating the product placement. I think it was the second season of Damages. And the one big plot point, and it was like, this episode of Damages is brought to you by, like, I think it was like Cadillac Escalade or one of those stupid things, or who knows what, but it was some big, you know, SUV from a major American car company. And I think it was Cadillac. And which I'm sure that's the whole point. I remember that, unless I get it wrong and then it didn't work. But a big plot point was they had to get in. They kept getting in and out of this car. Like it was like car porn shot. Every time the person was getting into it, like, oh, I guess that's the car. And then of course at the end, you know, every commercial break, it was like, it brought to you by, so every time you saw the car, you knew it was a product placement. So that's over heavy. But one of the plot points was they had to go in to the navigator, the GPS system, and track the last time they were in there. And they're talking about the car and they're turning it on. It's like the interior shots are all there and they're pressing the buttons to find out where they last were. I found that very annoying. But I will say real quickly, many years ago, I did ask the burgeoning trend when it was product placement in shows. Not like that, but like, why does he have to carry a Coke? He's, you know, et cetera. Clearly the label is right out in front, or this brand of beer. And we had a panel at TCA and someone said, well, it was very smart. They said, you know what? If they can do this in an organic way, quote unquote, where I'm involved and it's not the ad people at the network involved, and they get me involved and they say, hey, can you make this work? And I was a female director, and she said, if it takes me taking a beer bottle and artfully putting into a scene and it gets me a crane shot, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
She said, but I don't want my script and shooting a scene and then have the network come down and say, can you do like a wide shot of like people drinking these beers? She's like, that's not organic. But if you involve me in the process and I know that I'm already on a tight budget and I want a crane shot, which is expensive, I'm going to do it. I'll do it. Yeah. So I thought that was smart.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, and it can be artful, and it can be not a big deal. And the fact is, you have these products. Products do exist in the world with brands. So I always think about that with phones and with computers and things like that. That, you know, you're going to show somebody with a computer. I always laugh when I see an Apple laptop and there's a sticker on it. That means that Apple didn't pay them, and so they still have the Apple laptop. They just cover the logo up, so you don't know what laptop it is, except you totally do know.
You totally do know.
And then when you do see the Apple logo, then you know that the Apple did pay, and the same for other PC makers. There was one show, and I can't remember what it was now, where the product placement was Windows Phone, and it just made me laugh because nobody uses a Windows Phone, but everybody on that show used a Windows Phone. And it goes back to like Alias was all Nokia phones, and it was the same thing. It's like, really? Everybody has a Nokia phone?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
With the ringtone and all that. I don't know. It can be funny. It can be dumb. It can get you more money and make your show better. And if it's not done stupidly, it can be okay. I think that's fine. By the way, Tim, when you mentioned earlier that sometimes in the middle of the night you text me asking about what plug goes where, I have two comments on that. First off, I'm sleeping. I'm just mentioning this. I'm sleeping on a Casper mattress. Let me tell you about Casper, which, no, I'm not. There's no product placement in this episode. They didn't pay me enough. So I'm going to just – it's a mattress that I have that's available on the internet.
Yeah, I do
and
like
also,
Casper mattresses.
I'm not going to check the box or anything, but I'm going to say, when you text me about where you should put a plug in the middle of the night, I just turn over and go back to bed because I don't even want to know what's going on. Okay, let's leave on a big note here. We got Dan, who wrote in on Twitter to say, the Americans is usually so good at era appropriate, but it completely pulled me out of the moment when they had Selecticize paper towels.
Wow.
Wow, Eagle Eye Dan knows that back in the 80s, paper towels came in one size.
One size
You couldn't, like, they didn't perforate them closer together so you could get more or fewer. There was just the one size.
Dan
is the kind of person with an eagle eye who spots product placement.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very nice.
Focusing on the most important aspects of the American. Sometimes I wonder, and I'm not saying this is true about Dan, but sometimes I wonder if the most eagle-eyed people are the ones who are the most bored with the show. If you're not feeling it, I feel like that's when your eyes start wandering to details that are not.
Yeah, I never picked it up on that. That is very funny.
If you're wrapped, you just don't. You're just like, yeah, I'm into it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we're done.
That is, see, we were not as tight and bright because we had time.
We got a little more time. Let me tell people where they can reach us if they would like their letters considered for our last minute where we make answers up after having not read the questions before. You can email us. That's the best way. podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. That is the best way to do it. You can also tweet at us at TVTM, and you can post on the Facebook page, which is, it's kind of weird. You got to find the visitor posts place and all that, but it is there and I do look there. Facebook.com/TVTalkMachine. I am Jay Snell on Twitter and Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. That's it. So next week, we'll be back with more. But until then, Tim, have a great weekend.
All right, you too.
Bye, everybody.